Are we making any headway in better understanding the question of race? Harvard University's Dr. Henry Louis Gates sees progress.
I think that each year, our understanding of race and ethnicity becomes more nuanced, more textured, more layered.
Tonight in Cleveland, four writers whose work has led to that more nuanced understanding of race will be honored as the latest Annisfield Wolf Book Award winners. Today around noon, Dr. Gates talks about why the Annisfield Wolf is considered such a prestigious prize, and we meet two of this year's winners, Essie Adujan, author of Half-Blood Blues, and Lifetime Achievement Award winner Arnold Rampersad. Celebrating the 77th Annisfield Wolf Book Awards in this hour of around noon, it begins with news from NPR on 90.3. You're listening to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Thursday, September 13th. Tonight at 6 o'clock, here at Playhouse Square, inside the Ohio Theater, a group of talented writers accept a Cleveland-based prize of international stature. For more than 75 years, the Annisfield Wolf Book Award has come to symbolize the best in fiction and nonfiction that centers on the evils of racism and celebrates the diversity of humankind. Named for local philanthropist Edith Annisfield Wolf, this esteemed prize has gone to the likes of Toni Morrison, Junot Diaz, Edward Said, and Henry Louis Gates, Jr. This morning on 90.3, Sound of Ideas host Mike McIntyre spoke with the nonfiction winners of the 2012 Annisfield Wolf Award, and you can hear their conversation online now at WCPN.org. That's also where you can watch the webcast this evening of the award ceremony that begins at 6 p.m. Today around noon, we hear from this year's fiction winner, Essie Adujan, the author of Half-Blood Blues, and the biographer extraordinaire, who's the Lifetime Achievement winner, Arnold Rampersad. But we begin with the jury chair for Annisfield Wolf, who also serves as the host of tonight's ceremony, Dr. Henry Louis Gates, Jr. Earlier this week, I caught up with Dr. Gates, who interrupted working on a new documentary, a book, and the latest season of his PBS hit, Finding Your Roots, to talk with me. I asked him why, in the whirlwind of projects that is his life, he always makes time to be part of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards.
There is nothing like it in the United States. You know, back in the day, Dee, it was called the Black Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
And because very few authors, of course, were even considered for the Pulitzer Prize. And it was, you know, sort of the joke among the African-American literary community. And when you look at the list of winners, Zora Neale Hurston not only won it, but was put on the cover of the Saturday Review of Literature in 1940 for winning it for her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Road. Martin Luther King won it. So many great scholars and thinkers, and not all black, of course, people writing about race. And when I won it, it was one of the greatest honors of my life. And then after Ashley Montague passed, I was asked to chair the board and reform the whole process of selecting the winners and awarding the presentations. And so I picked this stellar jury, Simon Chama, the great historian, art historian at Columbia, Rita Dove, of course, Ohio's great poet, former poet laureate of the United States, Joyce Carol Oates, the brilliant, prolific professor at Princeton, and my colleague at Harvard, Steven Pinker, the brilliant psychologist and the scholar of the brain and how the brain works. And, you know, every year we get hundreds of submissions, and we argue back and forth through email, and then sometimes quite lively, spirited discussion, shall we say. And then, but in the end, we always have a unanimous vote.
And I want to circle back to the fact that the Annisfield Wolf Awards recognize books that contribute to our understanding of racism and appreciation of the rich diversity of human culture, but ask you if you think we as a society better understand racism now than, say, 10 years ago, or are we better able to articulate our feelings about race?
I think that's an interesting question. I think that each year our understanding of race and ethnicity becomes more nuanced, more textured, more layered. And the reason is we're developing more sophisticated ways to talk about race, both through science and through the humanities and the social sciences. The developments in DNA, and as you know, I've studied these. Mm-hmm. They're at the heart of my PBS series, Finding Your Roots. We can do things now in terms of analyzing your ethnic composition through your DNA, then, and I use the word ethnic in quotation marks because it's not exactly the same, more like your genetic population tributaries over the last 500 years since the time of Columbus. We can do things now very cheaply that didn't even exist 5 years ago. For instance, we can look at your DNA and tell you what percentage your ancestry is Native American, African, European, and now there are new companies, or companies are developing new tests that break down your Asian component or your European component more finely so that we can talk about your percentage of Jewish ancestry or Middle Eastern ancestry or Southern European or Northern African. It's amazing. And it's just really exciting. And what it shows, Dee, is that all of this talk about ethnic purity or racial purity, which characterized the pseudoscience about race in the 18th and 19th century, was pretty much total crap. That we're all mixed up. There are no pure people. That either through willing choice, love, or through, unfortunately, rape and enforced sexuality, that human populations have been interbreeding with each other since time immemorial, for as long as we can measure. And that's an interesting and more complicated way to be thinking about and defining race than any generation was able to imagine before us.
You're tuned to Around Noon on 90.3 and listening to a conversation with Harvard professor, PBS host, and jury chair for the Annis Field Wolf Book Awards, Dr. Henry Louis Gates. Tonight, Dr. Gates will be in Cleveland to host the Annis Field Wolf Awards ceremony at the Ohio Theater in Playhouse Square, beginning at 6 p.m. I spoke with Dr. Gates earlier this week, and he shared some of the thinking behind the choices of this year's award recipients, beginning with nonfiction winner David Blight.
Well, David's book called American Oracle, The Civil War and the Civil Rights Era, looks at how the Civil War was represented or remembered in the works of the great novelist Robert Penmore and the popular historian Bruce Caton, the man of letters Edmund Wilson, and our very own novelist and essayist James Baldwin. It explores these writers' thinking on the differences between remembrance and reality of the Civil War in the mid-1960s at its centennial. And what's interesting is that he shows, Dee, that the Civil War was used as a mirror to reflect historically the concerns that each of these writers had politically in the mid-1960s, so that for Robert Penn Warren, a Southerner trying to figure out his relationship to this emergent civil rights movement, and if it's moving too quickly, moving too slowly, the Civil War represents one body of data. And for James Baldwin, of course, who's looking for historical precedents for the justification of black and white participation in the Civil War and the finding of the black voice that the civil rights movement represented, the Civil War is quite a different kind of thing. So that he shows that often writers use different historical events in this way as a mirror or justification to reflect the way they're interpreting current events. And he's showing that no historical event in terms of race relations serves that purpose better than the Civil War. So that there's not one Civil War that emerges from the writing of these four men. It's four different Civil Wars.
Right. Another nonfiction winner was David Livingston Smith and his book Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. And I want to have you talk to the idea of what Smith sees as our capacity to do this, to do these things. Is it more of a question of culture or something about human nature innately?
Well, it's you put the, your finger on it. Surprisingly, he says it's something innate. His book participates in and inspires a conversation about what it means to be human and inhuman, which is why, with all the genocide and ethnic hatred around the world, which is why we wanted to honor this book. And he makes all of his readers contemplate the large questions of being human and human connections. In Smith's opinion, we're all too easily wired by nature to throw over our fellow human beings into the category of subhuman in order to exercise our will over them. A woman named Dr. Valerie Curtis, reviewing this book in the Journal of Evolutionary Psychology, said, books like Smith should be required reading for all with a social conscience, and his ideas out to find their way into every school curriculum. And David Barraby in the New York Times said that Smith reasonably argues that dehumanization is rooted in human nature, not in culture. And that's pretty frightening. if we're wired that way, what do we do about it? And so this is like an alarm bell. And we wanted to, it's a very sensitive philosophical account. The subtitle is interesting, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. He, by the way, is the co-founder and director of the Institute for Cognitive Science and Evolutionary Psychology at the University of New England. And if you think about the titles of some of his other books, The Most Dangerous Animal, Human Nature, and the Origins of War, which is about the biological roots of the human disposition to mass violence, and how self-deception allows us to override innate inhibitions against killing, and another book called Why We Lie, Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, about the biological foundations of deception, self-deception, and subliteral communication, you can see that this is very much a theme of his. Yeah. And the important thing is that we understand the roots of our inhumanity to man and so that we can check it, curb it, talk about it, police against it, because it is such a fundamental part of the human condition and always has been since the beginning of the human community.
With Essi Edujan, what were the things that struck the jury about this book that made them say, this is a fiction winner?
This novel, which is a marvelous read, is the story of a protagonist called Hieronymus Hero Falk, who's an Afro-German trumpet player in his band called the Hot Time Swingers, as they leave Berlin in 1939 for occupied Paris in 1940, where Falk is arrested by the Nazis. And the story is narrated by a character named Sid in present-day Baltimore. And the novel's been praised for its rhythmic language and perfect pitch evocation of the banter between these men in the band. It's also been praised for bringing a little-known corner of the African diaspora, Afro-German people, into public view. I mean, most of us don't know that there was a large group of Afro-Germans.
It surprised me.
You know, both before the war and after the war, certainly after the war because of the black soldiers who went to Germany. But we have lots of scholars are writing about this. Our own Vera Grant here at Harvard, encouraged by the support of one of our board members, Dr. Deborah Abel, who is herself, both of them are African-American women who have German mothers and African-American fathers, and they're very passionate about scholars encouraging scholarship on the Afro-German community in the United States and the Afro-German community back in Germany. And it's a brilliant novel. It's called Half-Blood Blues. There's nothing like it.
And finally, the Lifetime Achievement Award goes to Arnold Rampersad, who has written what many think of as the definitive biography of Langston Hughes, but also biographies of Ralph Ellison and Jackie Robinson. How do those tomes help us better understand race and diversity?
Well, the African-American community has been characterized for a long time by its impulse toward autobiography. We have one of the few traditions where, as a scholar pointed out, many black writers write their autobiography as their first book. and become famous that way. Maya Angelou is a great example. Frederick Douglass and all the 101 slave narratives published before 1866. These were all first books. Well, in everybody else's tradition, Dee, if you think about it, you write your autobiography after you become famous. Black people write their autobiography to become famous.
That is interesting.
And but we didn't have a strong tradition of writing biographies when a third person, another person would write the biography about Dee Perry, for instance. And that's what Arnold Rampe said, has excelled at and redefined. His first book, his PhD dissertation here at Harvard, was on the art and imagination of W.E.B. Du Bois. It wasn't a biography, but it was an intellectual biography. Then his Life of Langston Hughes in two volumes, 1986 and 1988. He co-authored the memoir of Arthur Ashe, and then the biographies of Jackie Robinson, 1997, and most recently Ralph Ellison. Arnold is a subtle lyrical writer, a sensitive literary critic. I always say, when I grow up, I want to be as smart as Arnold Rampe said.
And he must be pretty smart.
And he's a MacArthur Foundation Genius Award fellow and a member of the American Philosophical Society and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And then 2 years ago, the president conferred upon him the National Humanities Medal, which is the highest medal that a humanist can be awarded in the United States. I remember, well, I was totally stunned when President Clinton notified me in 1998 that I had won that, and that medal is one of the great prizes and treasures in my study. So we wanted to honor Arnold with a Lifetime Achievement Award. He's retired from Stanford. He's professor emeritus, and this award is for people in that phase in their career, and it honors the whole arc of their work, of their career. And so we think that he was the perfect choice for the Lifetime Achievement Award this year.
Excellent. Looking forward to being in your presence again this week in Cleveland. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you. Take care.
Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr. speaking with me recently about this year's Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. The awards ceremony takes place tonight at Playhouse Square inside the Ohio Theater starting at 6. If you can't make it downtown, you can watch the ceremony live online at WCPN.org. Coming up, American jazz musicians stranded in Paris at the start of World War II. We meet the fiction winner, Essie Adujan, who shares the story of Half-Blood Blues as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
This is 90.3 WCPN. Idea Stream.
Louis Armstrong, one of the most recognizable musicians of the 20th century. But in 1939, he's more than that for a trio of jazz musicians in Paris. For Sid Griffiths, Chip Jones, and Hieronymus Falk, the man known as Satchmo is a saving grace. He's their ticket out of World War II, which is fast approaching as the Nazis march towards the City of Light. This is the story told in the captivating novel Half-Blood Blues by Essie Adujan. Tonight, she accepts the Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction, and she joins me now in Studio 4 of Idea Center at Playhouse Square. Essie, congratulations and welcome. It's very good to have you here.
Oh, thank you very much, Dee.
Well, you traveled to Germany as a writer in residence in Stuttgart. I want to have you describe that time in your life and your impressions of moving to and living in Germany.
Yeah, it was a case where I was going there to do some research on a novel that I actually didn't end up publishing. So I was there for an entirely different reason and just, you know, decided to kind of, you know, throw myself into this experience. So I was doing a lot of traveling around the country as well as to other various European countries. But, you know, I was taking German lessons at one point, you know, I was studying German for 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, and just trying to immerse myself in the culture. And, you know, then I started to really think about the history of Black people in Germany and doing some research into it and, you know, stumbling across, you know, a few English language resources and just being fascinated by, you know, by the various stories.
And did you get into that history after being in the country, or did you know about it before you went to Germany?
I know a little bit about it, just, you know, kind of having visited the Holocaust Museum in Washington and, you know, done a bit of research. But really, I think a lot of these stories were, you know, were not ones I'd heard. And I wasn't, you know, really, you know, really cognizant of the fact that the presence went back so far, and also this story of the quote unquote Rhineland bastards, who were the children of French colonial soldiers and Afro-German, or sorry, and German women, you know, who kind of emerged out of relationships, you know, between these French colonial soldiers and these women after the First World War. You know, this wasn't something that I knew about, or obviously that I'd learned about in school. So,
And that most people would know about either. So when you began to think about creating a story around this, how did jazz become the through line?
Yeah, this kind of came out of left field. I'd always had a, you know, this abiding interest in the whole jazz era and, you know, and also and how that manifested itself in Germany, you know, it being this great time of avant-garde art happening, you know, after the First World War. And just, you know, researching a bit into, you know, this whole kind of, you know, renaissance happening there. And also, you know, the fact that all of these African-American musicians who felt very disenfranchised at home, you know, just going over and feeling very liberated to be playing in, you know, in the various clubs of Europe. And we think about it in terms of it happening very much in France and in Paris and, you know, the whole jazz scene in Montmartre. But, you know, you don't really think so much about what was happening in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And so I was really interested and fascinated to do some research into that and see it was very much alive there.
The main characters of the book are musicians in the Hot Time Swingers, a band made up of American and German players playing in Berlin in the late 30s. What kind of jazz scene did you discover was there, and how did the taste change once the Nazis, or as they call them in your book, the Boots, came to power?
Yeah, so in the 20s you had, I mean, it was, you know, quite similar to what was happening in Paris. And in fact, a lot of the musicians kind of went back and forth between the cities. You think of Sidney Bechet having played, you know, in Berlin and in some of the great clubs there. And, you know, Josephine Baker. A lot of these larger names, you know, were also playing, you know, the larger cities of Germany, also Munich. And, you know, in the south. But, yeah, it was a time of great, you know, this great creative output in terms of, you know, in terms of music in general.
And did your research tell you that there were appreciative audiences for this music, for these men?
Yeah, I think a lot of these musicians felt that certainly much more than what they were getting at home, where they felt like, you know, this was something that, you know, certain segments of the population were very interested in. But certainly it sort of felt like it was a larger thing in Germany, that they could go over and feel that there was a real taste for, you know, for music that was utterly new, or for art forms that were totally new and different. Now, in certain cases, this interest was sort of felt like it was, you know, a bit of a taste for something
of the exotic.
Exotic, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so, you know, there is that kind of double-sided thing happening. But you know, they felt appreciated. They felt like they could ply their trade. They could, you know, feel that they were, you know, they could pursue their art, you know, with great acceptance. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was in place there. But then, of course, you know, 1933 rolls around and, you know, they found themselves increasingly shut out and persecuted and finally, ultimately prohibited from playing in public.
And as your book demonstrates, even walking in public was hazardous to your health and your life.
Yeah. You know, obviously, if you're very, very clearly, you know, African American or of African descent, this was something where it was, you know, extremely, could be very perilous to be walking in the streets. And, you know, one of the things that I was trying to explore in this book was how, you know, we have quite a few mixed race characters, and, you know, this, they're all sort of different, you know, with different physical makeups. And so, you know, you have somebody like Sidney Griffiths, who, you know, somebody would mistake for, well, it, you know, as he was saying, you know, he was often taken for a white man, and how this allows him to kind of flow through the society in a much more fluid fashion than somebody like Hieronymus Falk, who is German born, but, you know, looks quite a bit more identifiably African, excuse me, but, you know, who was
but
a German and who
German.
Speaks fluent German and who was very much a German and very much, you know, a part of this society, whereas Sid is a foreigner, but he feels like he can kind of, you know, be more socially accepted.
I would love to have you share a passage from the book. Could you tell us a little bit about it before you do?
Sure. Basically, I'm going to read just a short part from, you know, when Chip and Sid are trying to leave Paris. You know, it's just the Germans have just come in, and, you know, everybody's panicking because they're not entirely sure what's going to happen. And so you've got the whole city kind of moving en masse, you know, this great exodus, but, you know, everything's congested. Nobody's able to sort of get to where they need to go. So I'll just start there. Okay. And just to explain who Chip is, he's the drummer of the band. And Sid is, of course, our main character, who's the bassist. You could hear the low stream of voices from blocks away. But even that ain't prepared us for the sight of the Gare d'Austerlitz. The chaos was stunning. A horde of terrified folk writhing in a wild crush of bodies, scrambling over each other and hauling trunks, cases, and crates as Janes fainted and kids screamed. All of it washing up hard against the spiked iron gates of the station. The stink of that wretched crowd like to knock a man down. And always the wave of shouts, screams, cries, the high shrieking of kids agonized by the savage heat. When I lifted my eyes, I seen the clouds roiling overhead in long plumes of yellow smoke, like the air done turned to poison up there. A jaundiced light filtered down over everything. I felt my heart lurch in my chest. "Aw, hell," I said. Chip gave me a sharp punch. "What is it, brother? You ain't never been to an Orioles game? It's just a crowd. A crowd with teeth. We ain't never gonna find them and all that. Folk got a way of finding each other. You see. Now stay close." He plunged right in. We was jounced and shoved and dragged apart, and then Chip was grabbing my damn shirt front and popping the buttons as he hauled me close. The heat streamed over us in a sharp wave of foul air. And I breathed shallowly, trying to catch even the smallest bit of oxygen in all those fumes. Sweat ran down my temples. Chip dragged me forward. We stood there in the brutal heat, sweat glistening on our necks and arms, not looking at each other. I was blinking my stinging eyes when I felt a hand on my shoulder and turned. It was a young woman holding a child high up over her head. She shouted something at me in French. "English?" I called at her. "You speak English?" "Le bébé," she said. "Passez-lui aux portes." "What?" A tall man in a blue shirt was looking at us. He shouted in French. "Le bébé," she said again. "Il les laisse passer à la salle d'attente. C'est trop dangereux pour eux ici." And she ain't even waited for me to understand. just dumped this soft, wet thing in my hands and gestured over my head to the next jack. It's Dart to Squallen. I handed it along. Chip started dragging me through it all, rolling past all them damp shoulders. I stumbled on something soft underfoot. Glancing down, my stomach wrenched at the sight of a woman just lying there, trying to protect her face with mud-caked hands. Before I could reach down for her, some other jack hauled her up and we were shoved along. A sea of panting faces, women in shawls clutching bundles and raw hands, men with suitcases grasped hard against their chests. The heat was strong and moist, and with every step a new smell rolled over me like a strong current.
Those are the words of Essie Adujan. She was reading from her novel, award-winning novel, Half-Blood Blues. Tonight at 6, Essie accepts the 2012 Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction, and that'll happen here at Playhouse Square in the Ohio Theater. And Essie, one of the things that passage points out is the language that you use, the Jacks and Janes and other kinds of things that were part of the slang of that time. What sort of research helped you to get into that mindset?
Yeah, I think basically it started with me just reading biographies of figures like Louis Armstrong and watching old footage. There's a wonderful documentary about the life of Duke Ellington in which Armstrong comes in at the end and they have this kind of banter between them. And, you know, the way they're talking, it's utterly different. But, you know, Armstrong just had this really warm... you know, this really warm way of speaking that's unlike anything else. But also, you know, reading Sidney Bechet's autobiography, which he dictated. So it's all, you know, written down in his vernacular. But also, you know, a lot of the language, I was playful with it. You know, I didn't just kind of stick with stuff from that era. I also needed to kind of extrapolate to say, okay, well, they're in Nazi Germany. So, you know, we do need words to describe the Nazis as well as other things. So it was just, it's a combination of invention and...
And invention that has won you several awards, but it's a bit ironic because there was a time when you thought this book wasn't going to be published at all. What happened and how did you overcome that?
Yeah. It was a long road to publication, it's true. It was about 7 years between this and my first novel. And many kind of bizarre things had to happen to get to this place. You know, one publishing house went bankrupt, and you know there was just a lot of stuff in between. So I'm thrilled that it all worked out, and that you know certain people believed enough in the book to keep it afloat. And yeah, I'm just very pleased to see it in print.
And the Annisfield Wolf Book Award, was that an award that was on your radar before you won it?
To be honest, no, not so much. You know, when I did hear about it and looked into it and saw this, you know, this amazing history and pedigree to the award, I was so, you know, I'm just so honored. And it's, I'm so honored to be accepting this award. It's incredible.
And it's a lovely book, full of rich detail. So congratulations to you once again. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
My guest has been Essie Adujan, the winner of the Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction for this year. Her novel is Half-Blood Blues, and she'll be accepting her prize in a ceremony that takes place tonight at 6 here at Playhouse Square inside the Ohio Theater. For more information on Half-Blood Blues, the awards, and a link to the webcast of tonight's ceremony, you can log on to our homepage. That's online at aroundnoon.ideastream.org. Coming up, the man who wrote the definitive biography of Cleveland's greatest poet, Langston Hughes. We meet Hughes biographer and Lifetime Achievement Award winner for Annisfield Wolf, Arnold Rampersat. You'll hear that as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
Thank you.
It is 17 minutes before 1 o'clock as you're tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. Tomorrow, we preview the festival where art and technology meet, Ingenuity Fest. Two of this year's participants will join us, one who wants to put music making into the hands of the people. The other will help attendees create a collaborative work of art using iPads. Previewing Ingenuity Fest around noon tomorrow on 90.3. The men that Arnold Rampersad has written about have been successful, but much of that success was achieved in spite of those in power, those who didn't want to give them a chance, and after they triumphed, give them their due. Rampersad's writing corrects that injustice. This year's Annisfield Wolf Book Award Lifetime Achievement Award winner has spent his career telling the stories of African Americans who've helped shape the history of their people, and by telling their stories, Rampersad illustrates the important place they play in American culture at large. Arnold Rampersad is a professor emeritus at Stanford University, and we are very pleased to welcome him to today's Around Noon. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
You, sir, once said that some might dismiss the education you received growing up on the island of Trinidad as being colonial. Do you feel that that helped or hindered you when it came to understanding American biography?
I think it helped me. I hope it did. It was old-fashioned in many ways, but an old-fashioned education is better than no education at all. It did stress learning various languages, including Latin, which I suppose doesn't strike one as being extremely relevant to much that's happening these days or in our times. But I think it provided me with a just regard for education, for learning, for inquiry into the world around me. So I'm quite satisfied with my education.
Right. I'm curious what the racial climate was, if there were parallels with what was going on in the U.S. or if it was a more acceptingly diverse culture.
No, well, it was at one level homogeneous culture. I mean, the slogan was "All of we as one," all of us are one people. The reality was somewhat different. You had some of the old colonial arrangements. You know, whites were at the top of the social ladder. You had divisions between people of African descent and people of East Indian descent, who made up the bulk of the population. So it was both harmonious, but also tense from time to time. And I think that was a good preparation for the United States.
Mm. As a biographer, you're able to blend literature, history, psychology, research. Do you feel it gives you the best of all possible worlds as a writer?
Well, for me, it does. I was never really interested in writing literary criticism, old-fashioned literary criticism, analyses of poems and so on, although I do that as part of my teaching and also as part of my biographical work. I was always interested in history as well as literature and sociology, and I think all those disciplines had to be brought to bear on the subject of trying to understand the life of someone like W.B. Du Bois, for example. And in addition, I mean, I'm a failed writer, a failed novelist.
Or, I was going to say, you're not a failed writer.
Or a wannabe novelist, or wannabe a poet. Biography allows you to draw on the techniques of fiction as you try to tell your story in an attractive way.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say about the biographies of yours that I've read. They read like novels, but they also give so much detail in an unburdening kind of way. That is, you don't find yourself saying, I have to remember that he did this in this year and that in that year. You blend all of those things, the facts and the slant on the person's psychology, to create something that's really vivid and very engaging to read.
Well, thank you. I mean, I certainly aim for that. I try to adhere to the highest standards of scholarly research. I try not to invent anything. I try to draw all the facts into, bring them to bear on the subject. But I also want from start to finish to hold the reader and to tell a story of a life in as compelling a way as possible. When people say, well, it reads a bit like a novel, I take that as a compliment because I mean I'm consciously trying to make sure that the story lives.
You brought your first biography out of a dissertation on W.E.B. Du Bois. Was there something you felt that other writers missed about his life, about his impact that you wanted to say, that you had to say?
Absolutely. When I read the books on Du Bois, I simply, written mainly by historians, I simply didn't recognize the Du Bois. I felt I knew through reading The Souls of Black Folk and other of his books. All the, he was often treated as a kind of another civil rights leader from the dawn of the century, when in fact this was man had many, many skills, but he was profoundly a poet, I think, and profoundly a prophet. He had a vision of the world that went far beyond any single discipline he was involved in, and he was tremendously important to our understanding of America and the world. I found that missing, and so I was perfectly motivated, let's put it that way, when I set out to try to correct the story, redress the shortcomings that I saw in the work of people who approached his life in a more limited way.
Once again, I remind you that I am talking with Arnold Rampersad, who joins us in Studio 4 for today's Around Noon on 90.3. This evening at 6, he receives the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards Lifetime Achievement Award in a ceremony at the Ohio Theater at Playhouse Square. And you can find out more about the ceremony by logging on to our website, wcpn.org. Another thing that I was noting is how much rich detail you add in. It's almost as if you're sitting in the hip pocket of the person who you're writing about. And I wonder what it takes to get to that place. How many things you have to plow through? For instance, for the two volumes of Langston Hughes' biography.
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I do believe that the details are very important. Some people would say that I overdo it in places. Do we really need to know what Langston Hughes had for breakfast in his hotel in Havana in 1932? Well, I think so. I mean, I was trying consciously from the beginning to bring to life African American culture at a certain level. You know, there are many aspects to the culture as it had never been done before. I think you humanize someone by bringing forward as many facts about the life as you can, while making the story interesting. So, for me, the accumulation of facts is always important. Yeah, even though I also keep in mind the need to tell a story.
Yeah. But you mentioned a few minutes ago that someone, I think it was about Du Bois, people had written about him as an historian. Do you not see yourself as that too?
As a historian?
As an historian.
Well, historians are always telling me I'm not a historian. Biography is held in high regard by some historians, but in low regard by others, because I think some historians think that a single life is not a reliable lens by which to understand the past. I think that's mistaken. It's one lens. It's not the only lens, but I think it's an invaluable lens to learn about the past, say the 1920s, through a detailed description, narration of the life of Langston Hughes, I think is indispensable.
Yeah, I got a very clear picture, more clear than some history books I've read, about the eras, about the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the political and social climate that was going on, and the racial as well, from all of those details. So
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that if you follow, you track a life, especially a life that was lived as actively as Langston Hughes lived his life, and you deal with his interactions with all these different peoples from East European emigre composers ordinary folk about him in Harlem and so on, and you see how the life is actually lived from day to day, from month to month, from year to year, you gain a picture of that culture, of those successive unfolding of the culture that you can't get by straight-laced history.
On the other hand, when you were approached to write the biography of Jackie Robinson, you were reluctant at first. I was reading. What made you change your mind?
Well, when I spoke to Mrs. Robinson, Rachel Robinson, a remarkable person, and Jackie Robinson's widow, she stressed that there had been many books written about Jackie Robinson, but almost all of them had emphasized baseball and also his momentous step in 1947 when he integrated Major League Baseball. But she wanted a story told of the entire life, and that appealed to me immediately. So I spent as much time on the life before 1947 when he broke the color barrier as I did on the baseball, and then there was the life after baseball, so that again one had the picture of a complete human being, or at least an attempt to paint a picture of a complete human being, warts and all. So that was my justification for taking on this task, even though I had not grown up in a baseball culture, but a cricket and soccer culture.
Mm. Among the biographies that you've written, I'm curious if there were things in the lives that surprised you, that shocked you, and also characters, human beings, whom you found yourself admiring more than you thought you would.
Yes. you take on these lives of prominent people. They obviously start off being on a kind of pedestal, and then you begin to break down the life, as it were. Take someone like Langston Hughes. He was an enormously fetching person. I mean, a very lovable person, especially as a young man, a brave person, a poet who wanted to see the world and saw the world by dint of his aggressive approach to the business of living life and his creative approach to being African American in a world where African Americans were not highly regarded. So then you move further into the life, and you see him in lower moments, lesser moments, moments of compromise, say, and you discover things that complicate the picture. Mm-hmm. I always was committed to telling all sides of the story, whether the person had made mistakes, they had to be brought forward. When they had their triumphs, they had to be assessed and noted and given their due. And so in each case, I think there were ups and downs. Jackie Robinson, Ralph Ellison, all these people had their highs and their lows, and I thought it was my business to record both.
Could you write your own autobiography, would you prefer that someone else find the man that Arnold Rampersad is?
Well, I don't think my life is important enough to merit a biography. I have dabbled in memoir writing, trying to tell the story, but I'm not sure I'm making a great deal of progress. Right. I'm not sure many people would want to read about my life, but you have to reflect on your life all the time. We all do. And it's at least as hard to understand oneself as it is to understand, say, someone like Ralph Ellison or W.B. Du Bois, another person altogether.
Mm. Well, I am very glad that you have written about other people, and in the process we learn something about you, too. And another thing I want to mention is that we're very pleased to have you in Cleveland for the Annisfield Wolf Awards, and a well-deserved honor. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
My guest has been Arnold Rampersad, the 2012 Annisfield Wolf Lifetime Achievement Award winner. Tonight at 6, he and three fellow writers will receive their awards in a ceremony at the Ohio Theater at Playhouse Square. Find out more and catch a webcast of the ceremony by clicking on a link at WCPN.org. Thanks for listening as you stay tuned to 90.3.
You're listening to 90.3 WCPN, Cleveland. Idea Stream.